This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Melanie Oppenheimer is the Chair of History at Flinders University and joins us. Hello, Melanie.
Good morning.
Melanie, do you think that Catherine Helen Spence is not recognised as much as she should be?
Well, I certainly think that she's not a household name, I don't think, as she was during her lifetime. I think we recognise her to a certain degree, but I think we could always learn a bit more.
It's interesting. I mean, is that something that we can say about a lot of pioneering women in Australia, that they're perhaps not given the recognition they deserve in Australian history?
I think so. I mean, sort of history fads come and go, don't they? And sometimes people are really well known and then they fall out of our knowledge, depending on the history curriculum and things like that. And I think that that often does happen, particularly with important women in our past, because history is, you know, sometimes it's skewed in particular ways. And some people talk about, you know, history is just all generally seems to be about dead white men.
How did she get her way onto the $5 note for the recognition of Federation along with Henry Parkes?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think it's because she was, you know, she is known as a key female figure of the Federation era. And when they were making that commemorative issue for the Centenary Federation in 2001, they made this commemorative $5 note. And so I guess she was a prime candidate because she, you know, like Henry Parkes was the, you know, the founding father of our Federation, and I guess you could argue that Catherine Helen Spence was our founding mother. So it was sort of a pretty good balance, you know, on either side of the note. But she did then bump Carolyn Chisholm, who was also, you know, like she was, Carolyn Chisholm is actually a female figure, in fact, who probably has slipped even further into the you know, background of history, because she was a social reformer of the colonial era that really I don't think we talk much about at all. So, you know, you have Catherine Helen Spence coming on in place of her, but then, you know, Catherine being bumped for the Queen in more recent times. I don't know about you, but I have to confess I would prefer to see Australia as a republic, and I think that's a really interesting, I don't know who made that decision, but I think that's really telling.
How important was she to bringing women the vote?
She was integral. She was one of, I mean, there were a number of women around the period of Federation that brought women the vote in South Australia, because Catherine Helen Spence grew up in South Australia. But she's one of the founding mothers. She's one of the pioneers of the women's vote, and she's a key player in that field.
Did she do that because she was outspoken? Did she do that through internal political reform? How did she go about it?
Well, she was quite elderly by the time of when the whole sort of suffrage debate was. Sort of coming to a climax in Australia in the 1890s and around the turn of the century. I mean, she dies in 1910 and she's 84, I think, but she does. So she's right at the end of her career. But so it sort of looks like a natural progression. She goes through a series of social reforms. She's a political innovator, as it were, in a number of different areas. And I think women's suffrage sort of like is one of the last issues of reform for her. So that, I think that's sort of how she, you know, she spent her life really working towards many, many issues of social reform, and I guess, you know, women's suffrage is a key one.
And so for her, this is towards the end of her life, and she was quite well respected within the community up to this time, so she was listened to.
Yeah, exactly. She's an elderly woman. I mean, all the images that you see of her, she's of taken in her latter years. So she's the image that's on the note, for example, is of a woman of a certain age, and she's a contemporary of Queen Victoria. I think Queen Victoria is only a couple of years older than her. So they, you know, she's very much a symbol of that whole Victorian era. And the image that we have of her is of sort of the white head, slightly severe, but with a sort of a nice gentle face, but of a well, a rounded face of a woman of a certain age.
Let's go back and take a look at how she came here and under what conditions she came here.
Yeah, well, she's from a Scottish origin. So she's born on the 31st of October, 1825, near Melrose. So she's on the borderlands of Scotland and England. So Melrose is just south of Edinburgh. She's the fifth of eight children. Her father was, she's born into very much a sort of a middle-class Scottish family. Her father is a lawyer and a banker. Her mother comes from generations of what they would call respected tenant farmers. So she's very much of that middle-class milieu. And I think in the early, sort of the first 10 years or so of her life, it's a very stable, she writes an autobiography and she, you know, it's very happy. Parents are happily married and it's a very sort of genteel existence. And then her father speculates his money on a wheat deal or something like that. And anyway, loses almost all the family money. And I think, which is an interesting, I mean, people obviously emigrate to the colonies of Australia or you know, around the world for many different reasons. And it appears as if the Spence family emigrates to South Australia as if it's the last possible destination of the vast British Empire that one could go if one had made some you know, dubious financial dealings that ended up in this dreadful situation of bankruptcy. So they end up, the family emigrates to Adelaide, to South Australia. They arrive in 1839 when the colony is only 3 years old. So they arrive, the Spence family arrives right at the beginnings of the beginnings of the South Australian colony.
And they, what, go onto a farm or they live in the city or what do they do from there?
They live in the city and it seems as if they actually, I think, I think times are quite tough in those first years. I mean, there's descriptions where they live in a tent for a number of months until they can find suitable accommodation. They are very short of money. But her father, David Spence, he ends up becoming Adelaide's first town clerk. So he gets a job. But from what I can understand, I think that his health is broken by this terrible financial tragedy that's befallen the family. And he never really recovers. He dies, I think, within a couple of years of them arriving in Adelaide. So the family have to then rely on the children going out to work. Catherine becomes a governess at the age of 17. She grows up and I think the family's quite enlightened. So the father and mother both say that, yes, boys and girls need to have education. Education's the key. And she always wanted to be a teacher and a writer. But the bankruptcy and the family's immigration means that she can't go to school in Edinburgh where it had been planned that she would go. And it's so when they get to Adelaide, you know, she does what, you know, only middle-class girls and women can do, and that is to teach. So she ends up being a governess and bringing in sort of an income or, you know, help the family to sort of bring an income in those early years.
You mentioned that she wanted to be a writer. Did that happen early in her life?
Reasonably early. Reasonably early. I think that she always had this interest in writing. She had an interest in teaching. I think she had an interest in doing something that maybe that wasn't something that women normally did. I mean, of course, women, there are well-known women writers in her era, but certainly in Australia it was something that there weren't many of. I mean, I think women were sort of just surviving and pioneering and doing all those things. Actually, being a writer was not something that women really did in those times.
What did she do from being a governess? Did she go into teaching or did she move in a different direction?
No, she went into the family with her sister and the mother. They set up a school, so they sort of dabbled in that area of education because, as I said, education, they considered education to be very, very important, particularly for women. But she always wanted to do something more. So she writes a novel. It's said that she's the first female novelist in Australia, and I think that in that sense, I mean, there may well have been women writing novels that weren't published. You know, it's a pretty big claim, isn't it, to say that, you know, she's the first first novelist. But she's the first published female novelist in Australia. She writes a book called Clara Morrison, Life on the Goldfields, published in 1854. So I think from that perspective, with the publication of the book in London, that, yeah, she's the first novelist.
So was that successful, not only in England but in Australia?
Moderately successful. I mean, she couldn't retire. I think she got paid a small amount of money, but not a great deal. But that was a two-volume novel, sort of slightly autobiographical, I think, even though she insisted that it was a novel, which it was, but it was about an educated young woman who migrates to South Australia from Scotland.
Funny that.
So I think that she the novels that she does write do have a sort of she writes about what she knows. So it's about her family, as I said, had a tough time in the early years in Adelaide, and I think she uses this in her writing as fictional stories of adversity and hardship for a young woman in particular. So she has a young woman as at the centre stage of her novels. And I think that a lot of what she writes about is about her own experience.
Miles Franklin compared her to Jane Austen. Were they of that romantic bent?
Yes, they were. I think she's isn't it interesting that Jane Austen's now just appeared on the British £10 note, I believe.
Oh.
So that's another, you know, they have something there in common. You know, they're both appearing on the on currency. So I think perhaps she's obviously not well known like Jane Austen is for her novels. I think they were sort of romantic.
Romanticising perhaps what was a pretty tough time.
Yeah, exactly. And she's much more well known, I think, not necessarily for her novels, but for her other writing that she does through her life.
Well, tell us about that other writing, because she was well recognised for speaking her views.
This is where she is. She really does blaze a trail for women, and she does pretty unusual things. I mean, she becomes a daily columnist in a newspaper here in South Australia called the South Australian Register. Now, initially, she wrote anonymously or under a pen name, I think probably because she, people might take her more seriously if they didn't realise that she was a woman was penning these pieces. But you know, she had a good turn of phrase. She wrote really well. So she wrote she had a daily column, and she wrote about a range of issues, you know, political, social, economic issues that were pertinent to the time. And I think it's those pieces. Catherine Spence actually later on says that, you know, if you sort of want to understand me, you look at those sorts of writings. And indeed, Susan McGarry, who is a historian here, a very well-known historian here in Adelaide, Spence's biographer in 1985, you know, she actually says that Spence had four careers, that she was firstly a novelist, and then she moves on to being a philanthropic welfare worker. She's then a journalist, and then lastly a public speaker. And she earns a good enough income through her journalistic work to actually support herself. So, yeah, she becomes very well known for that.
Did the newspaper know that she was a woman, firstly?
Yeah.
And was that okay with the newspaper, but it wasn't perceived to be okay in the public?
Yes, I think that even her first novels were actually published anonymously. I mean, there was just this thing that I think, you write under a nom de plume, under a male name, or you just, write for someone in the colonies or something like that. Yeah, it's just that people would take you more seriously if there was some ambiguity, or in fact that they thought you were a man. it was that tough. You know, that's how hard it was for women, breaking these sorts of barriers in the 19th century.
At what point was it that she could come out, so to speak?
Well, I think that she it's as much her as her own self-confidence. So once she feels confident, she's writing these pieces, she's being paid well, she then thinks, OK, right, fine, you know. I can put my name, my own name, to these pieces. And look, no one says a thing. People actually continue to buy the newspaper. People continue to be employed. I begin to do other things. She's commissioned by the South Australian Education Department, for example, to write the first social studies textbook in Australian schools in 1880. So, you know, she becomes a well-respected journalist or writer, you know, in her own right. So she develops that confidence, but it's only as an older woman, maybe as the woman in the image that we know about. So, you know, she takes her a while to grow into her and to give herself confidence to put her name to her writing.
Was she recognised outside of South Australia as well?
Yes, she was. And this is the end. I mean, when she dies in April 1910, she's aged 84, so she, you know, she lives to a ripe old age, and she's heralded as the grand old woman of Australasia. And she's a household name, not only in Australia and Australasia, so that means Australia and New Zealand, but internationally, because in her later years, she tours the world. I mentioned earlier that she was a highly regarded public speaker, so she was very good at standing, you know, and talking about a range of issues. But she travels the world, so she goes to America, she goes back to Britain, on talking on a range of issues. So she becomes... Yeah, she becomes very well known internationally, which again I think is interesting that some people are heralded, you know, it's only when they die that they become well known. Hmm. She is very well known during her lifetime and through the 20th century becomes less well known.
Was she a spokesperson for women? Was she a spokesperson for Australia? Or what were the issues that she spoke about?
She speaks about a number of things. I mean, interestingly, I mean, she really is an interesting woman. She, one of the main areas that sort of consumes her for most of her life is that, and she says actually in one of her writings that this is her main mission, actually not women's suffrage, but was proportional representation in voting, if you please. So this is at a time, this is, you know, when even, you know, the voting for men is staggered, you know, through the 20th century, through the 19th century. But she really believes that you need to devise a type of voting that actually represents minorities. So in the 19th century in the colonies, they had, you know, first past the post voting system, and she just didn't think that that was fair. So she takes on this idea about proportional representation of voting, which is... as I said, represents minorities. And that's actually a system of voting that a version of it that we use today in the Senate. So that, you know, and she really believed that this was an important feature of democracies. And that's one of the issues that she talks about around the world, that this is the sort of thing, voting systems that we should have. And so she talks about that as much as she then segues that into votes for women.
Because you mentioned earlier her work within the welfare system, is that what pointed her in the direction of recognising the importance for the vote for that voting system as well?
I think so, because as I said, you know, she has this, one of the areas that she spends a lot of time, her life working in is philanthropy and looking after social welfare for the most destitute in the colony. And, you know, the South Australian colony had just as many problems as that they had back in the UK, in Britain, in terms of those at the very bottom of the social sort of pecking order. And she works particularly for many years in reforming, working with destitute children and working with the whole system of developing a system of fostering of children who are either orphaned or whose parents can't look after them. And they, rather than have them institutionalised, which was the common practice, she was she spent most of her life sort of advocating for and then putting into practice this idea of fostering children in family homes. And indeed, she fostered a number of generations of children. Firstly, in her own family, she looked after one of her sisters when her sister died, which wasn't uncommon in the 19th century, for women to die in childbirth and whatnot. And so, who'd look after? She looked after those nieces and nephews, and then she sort of then parlayed that into working with other children and fostering and things like that. So she really, I think, was always looking at how to make a society more equal, how to look after those who the most vulnerable in our society. And I think that kind of all sort of, she saw that as this idea of proportional representation in voting was a part of that.
Melanie, did she formalise the fostering system in that did she work with governments to formalise the system, or was it something that she just did privately?
No, well, she said she worked with government and with philanthropic bodies. So in the 19th century, often it wasn't the government that sort of looked after the most vulnerable. It was, that's what Caroline Chisholm, her work in the mid-19th century, early 19th century, was setting up philanthropic organisations to help those that needed it. So there were different organisations that she helped, and working with governments and with philanthropic organisations. There was a boarding out society that she establishes, she also works with other, in terms of reform organisations.
That's pretty big, setting up a fostering program, especially at that time when institutions was considered to be the way to go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's why she really was. She was someone that had real innovation and was a deep thinker. I mean, and it was reasonably unusual for women to not only to work in philanthropic areas, because of course during the 19th century philanthropy became a key role for middle class women. Of course, there were few occupations. As I said, teaching was one of them. Being a governess, that was sort of something that a middle class woman could do. Later on, nursing became an occupation for the middle classes. But most middle class women weren't in the paid workforce, and what they did was their philanthropic work. So it wasn't unusual really for women to work in those spheres throughout the 19th century. But, to take a leadership role was. And one of the things that she did that she was also revolutionary in was women speaking in public. Because towards the end of the 19th century, although it became more accepted for women to do that, Catherine Helen Spence, it said that she was also the first woman to actually speak in public in South Australia, in Adelaide. They used to, she began to read papers at the South Australian Institute, which was a body that was established sort of for the dissemination of information and education and things like that. But she's the first woman to do so. So, that women could write things, but then men had to speak the papers.
And this is at a time when it was difficult for women to get into universities as well.
Women what? You wouldn't have known. Yes, exactly. Women didn't go to university at this time. Universities are only opened up towards the end of right at the end of the 19th century and then into the 20th century. So, yeah, you're right. They can't go to Adelaide University. They can write papers at the Adelaide Institute, but they can't present them. So she's actually she's the first woman that actually says, hang on, I can write these papers of interest and I'm going to read them too. So she develops, she becomes this renowned public speaker. And then and that's one of the things that when she tours internationally, that here's a woman who has the guts to get up and speak in public, that she actually has a good voice, and that she is worth listening to. So she breaks those barriers as well. I mean, she really is quite a remarkable woman in those areas of sort of breaking barriers. And I think there's this wonderful quote that when at her 80th birthday in 1905, so this is when women have the vote in South Australia and then in Australia, she's really, you know, she's really done an enormous amount. At her 80th birthday, she announces that she's a new woman and that she knows it. So this idea that of being a new woman who is politically aware, who knows her role and who will go out in the public arena, which is, you know, had been traditionally, a place for men, and that she will play a role. And so for someone in their 80s, you know, we talk about aging, aging and doing great things and continue to age. And yet here's someone at the turn of the 20th century who really is showing us how to age and age well.
Did she see herself as a suffragette, as somebody that was speaking on behalf of women, or as a person that wanted to make sure that all people are recognised?
Look, I think she was speaking on behalf of everybody, but also she wanted to. I mean, she knew she was a role model for Australian women, and she certainly there were, because of course she's not the only woman in that space at that time. There were a lot of Australian women that were very active, like Beta Goldstein and Rose Scott in New South Wales. But she really was seen as one of the leaders, and I think that by the end of her career, she that's why I think she probably is on the $5 note as opposed to someone like Rose Scott or Beta Goldstein, is because she really was, you could call her our founding mother, and she really played a key role in getting women the vote. White women the vote, we have to say, of course. She really is sort of a very special person in that way.
Ruth, good morning.
Yes, I'm wondering if you can talk about the novel Handfasted, which is an incredible novel that's not known at all. I went through a uni degree and taught literature. I'd never heard of it. But it's a thought novel projecting into the future about relationships between men and women. It's contemporary at the moment. She submitted it for a literary prize about 1870, I think, in South Australia, and all the male judges refused to accept it because they said it would cause a revolution, and it probably should have at that time.
Wow.
It's just one of the most unknown and most incredible pieces of work.
Tell us why do you think that she's important, as well as for her writing, but because of what she was writing about, Ruth?
Well, she took a role where she totally invaded or occupied the space of intelligence, and women were not given that space. And she did that very deliberately, but very calmly. She crafted her writing. She thought about it deeply. But she projected this view of equity between the genders, and this novel, Handfasted, really sets out how that could be worked out in practice. So Handfasted is where a couple can come together for a year and a day. It's in an imaginary culture somewhere, well, in another place. So it's an imaginary space. But this young man is shipwrecked. He finds his way there. He enters this group of people who've already organised these social relationships. And so a couple can join together for a year and a day. Then they decide whether they're going to get married or not.
Wow.
If they decide not to, then they can separate and then rejoin in another union later on if they want to. If a child is conceived through that time, then instead of being a bastard, as it was in the contemporary society of that time, then that child is elevated and given a special position within that group of people and is looked after within that whole community as a very special person. So she inverted all of the contemporary social relationships. And as a contemporary novel, it is just incredible.
And recognizing the people that are struggling at the time, and we did talked about her love of supporting people on welfare, but
absolutely
the people that are downcast.
Yes, no, she is incredible. And I also have to note from South Australia the work of Mary Lee as well, but Catherine Helen Spence, an incredible contribution to the whole culture of Australia, and she's not well enough known and her work is not well enough read.
Ruth, thank you for telling us about her. Melanie?
Yeah, no, I mean, a couple of things there. She actually was, she turned down two offers of marriage, conscious decisions that she made, which I think also says something about her, that she wasn't going to be pigeonholed into doing the traditional sort of roles of women of her era. And I think that takes a courage as well. But Handfasted, I agree, it was a novel that was submitted for a prize in the Sydney Mail around 1880, and it was rejected by the panel for the prize as calculated to loosen the marriage tie. It was too socialistic and therefore dangerous. She was writing, she was seen as a very subversive sort of character, which I think says something about the individual and also about the potential of, you know, what she was saying. So very interesting.
But it's interesting because you say that considered to be subservive, and that whole attitude towards women and men's attitudes towards women. But she also went about doing it quietly and managed to succeed. So she must have had an ability to be able to find a way through that.
I think you're right. I mean, it's interesting, you know, what sort of person was she? I think she had quite a general, a gentle nature, but quite persuasive. So she wasn't seen as a strident woman, but she could work. She worked within the system, in a sense, to pursue the rights for the underprivileged and for women and all those people who didn't really have a lot of power in society. But she did it in such a way that clearly those around her weren't threatened. So that actually takes quite a skill. So, in fact, even though she was a true politician in many ways, but working outside of the system, she's also said that she's the first woman to run for a political position in Australia, because she runs for one of the federation conventions that are held in Adelaide in the 1890s. I think she comes, you know, she doesn't get there and she gets right down the bottom of the pile, but she puts her name forward, the first woman to do so. But interestingly, once women then do get the vote and the right to stand for parliament, she doesn't do it. And some people have questioned, well, why, you know, after all this, you know, she doesn't actually then put her hand up and stand for parliament. But then on the other hand, you know, she's a woman nearing her 80s. Maybe she felt that she, you know, had done her bit and that was the last thing she wasn't going to do.
So she doesn't choose to go into politics because she's a bit older. However, she still continues to be active.
Absolutely, yes. So I think, you know, she's active in a sphere that she finds familiar, well, she's comfortable with at the end of her life. So she's a trailblazer. She's doing all sorts of things that women hadn't done to that point. But she continues in the sphere in which she's most comfortable.
What are the last years of her life like?
Well, they're very active. I mean, you know, she right up until her last days, you know, she's very active. And she sees herself, you know, as if she's moving forward. She's this new woman, trying all these new things. I think she'd probably say that at the end of her life, she would look back on it and with a sense of achievement. I mean, she does sort of do, you know, the things that she'd hoped to achieve, she's you could say she's successful, and she is well known in her own right, nationally and internationally. But of course, as the caller indicated, we don't. That's been lost through the 20th century.
Melanie, from what you know of her, what do you think would be her greatest achievement that she feels it was?
I think getting women the vote. I think pushing the boundaries in areas of journalism and writing. But she's most well known as in the suffrage area, I think. So that probably is a big claim to fame. Although, of course, you know, when you drill down, there's a lot more to her as well.
Melanie, thank you so much for telling us so much about her today, because I didn't know enough, and I don't know how other people feel, but I'm glad that I've learned a lot more about it this morning.
Oh, look, it's been my pleasure, Trevor. Thank you.
Melanie Oppenheimer, Chair of History at Flinders University, as we've taken a look at the very interesting life of Catherine Helen Spence.